good morning again. Our kids love to imitate us, don't they? They love to mimic us, love to follow our example. And you know what's interesting is when kids imitate us, sometimes it really makes us smile, like that video, and then sometimes they imitate actions that perhaps we wish they would not copy. And so oftentimes the things that they're imitating are things that we don't even know that they're paying attention. Case in point, back when I used to live up at that camp in North Carolina, my daughter Haley was about 16 months old. And we were down at the main camp facility, and she found a disposable camera. Y'all remember the disposable cameras that you just take 24 pictures or whatever and send it off and they would develop it? Well, she had found one. And she was 16 months old, and she got it, and she held it up to her face like this, and of course she didn't know how to press the buttons or whatever, but you could see her doing what she had seen other people do. And what was really interesting to me about it was Renee and I didn't even use disposable cameras. We had an SLR Minolta, and that was our camera, so we don't even know who she had seen doing that, but she was imitating them, and of course that was really cute. Then there was another time, this was my daughter Bonnie, she was about probably 4 years old, and all at once when she would get mad or frustrated, she would put her hands on her hip like that. And Renee was like, well, where does she get that from? And I said, well, you do that all the time when you're mad or frustrated. No, I don't ever do that. So over the next 2 weeks, I just kind of, when the opportunity presented itself, just kind of pointed it out to her that she did in fact put her hands on her hips when she was mad or frustrated. This morning, I want to examine Paul's statement over in the book of 1 Corinthians, where he instructs the Corinthians to imitate him or to mimic him. We're starting a short series this morning, a summer series called Passages. And that's actually kind of a dual play on words there. We're going to be obviously looking at some passages of Scripture, but we're also going to be talking about passages in the sense of like a journey, like a passage through life. And specifically, each of the pastors here at Burning Bush over the next 3 weeks is going to share a passage of Scripture that has deep meaning for them. A passage that has been highly significant and impactful in their life. It might be a life verse, it might be some sort of mission statement, or something that has some sort of real significance that was life-changing in their life. And so I'm going to kind of lead that off this morning by looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1. You know, this passage that I'm going to be sharing with you here in just a moment has significance in my life dating back to about 26 or 27 years ago. I was in my early 30s and I was in a Bible study, and we were studying the book by Stephen McCovey called The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. And we were kind of going through that together, and he mentioned one of the 7 habits as being having a personal mission statement. Now, I was real familiar with business mission statements, and schools have mission statements, and colleges have purpose statements, and churches have mission statements. But it had never kind of occurred to me about having a personal mission statement. And so that kind of started me on a spiritual journey that lasted 2 or 3 months, and just kind of writing thoughts down and working through some things. In fact, all the rough drafts and notes and stuff that I originally took down, I still have in a cabinet behind my office, and occasionally I'll dig them out and kind of refresh things a little bit. But that's how that journey kind of came about. And as I started to think, well, what do I want my life to be about? And what do I want my motivations to be? And how do I want to measure my life? And what do I want to be important? What do I want my values to be? And so I started trying to craft a mission statement for my own personal life. And this was kind of the goal. Obviously, to keep me on track, But then when I get to be 70 or 80, whatever, whenever God decides to take me home, I want to be able to look back and say, you know, that's what I wanted to be about. That's what I wanted my life to be about. And not look back and go, well, you know, I just kind of flirted from one thing to the next, did this a little bit, did that a little bit, but never really had a target. And so that's kind of the purpose in my own mind of why I developed this. And during that time, during my personal devotions, I came across a verse that probably read lots of other times, and just, you know how you read a verse and then one day God just kind of impresses it upon you and it kind of stands out. And that's what happened in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1. I was in my personal devotions and that particular day, and I was in that, working on that personal mission statement anyway, God just kind of impressed this verse on me as to be a life verse. Now here's something that's really, really important that I want you to understand. And when we read this in a minute, you'll understand where I'm coming from. This is really important. Not a single day do I live up to this verse. Not a single day. I fail at it every day. I will never live up to this verse. But I want you to know that up front, because if not, this could come across as extremely arrogant, and it's not that way at all. So our text this morning is 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1. It's just a really short verse. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, follow my example as I follow Christ. Before we kind of dive into that verse and kind of break it down, as we talked about last week, context is really important. And so I just kind of want to give you some background information before we kind of break that really short verse down. And the Corinthians, who Paul is writing to, lived in the city of Corinth. And there's some things I want you to know about Corinth, because it'll help you understand where this verse is and why Paul mentions it. The city of Corinth was kind of located on this narrow strip of land that kind of connected part of Greece with the main part of Greece. And it was just this narrow isthmus, and it was located and connected the Aegean and the Adriatic Seas. One author wrote this about the city of Corinth. Corinth was perched like a one-eyed titan astride this narrow isthmus connecting the Greek mainland. It was one of the dominant commercial centers of the Hellenic world. When Paul arrived, it boasted a population of about 500,000 people. That's a pretty good-sized city in New Testament times. Its seaports were the keys to its opulence. There were two seaports there, one on each side of the city. And commercial ships, and I think we have a map here, if y'all can throw that map up on the screen. I hope you can see where Corinth is, and there's that isthmus there, and Corinth is just seated right between those two ports. And so what ships would do, they would dock, and then they would portage or carry their cargo across that isthmus, because it was a whole lot easier than trying to navigate some of the really difficult seas and channels around the island there. And so they would just carry their stuff across. Well, because of that, lots of people were always there, and they became a very wealthy city with all these goods kind of flowing in and out of the city. And, of course, people that had money also wanted to indulge in pleasure, which kind of brings me to the third thing that I want you to know about Corinth this morning. At the highest point in Corinth was a pagan temple of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. There were over 1,000 prostitutes there to meet the needs, so to speak, of their devotees. And Corinth's reputation for sexual promiscuity was so widespread that there was even a term coined. You know what that term was? To Corinthianize meant to practice sexual immorality. So they actually took the name of the city and kind of turned it into a verb. So it was known for its sexual immorality. Something else it was known for was the Ismanian contest, which were kind of like the Olympics, but not quite the same thing. And they were held every 2 years. And these events would include boxing. It would include pancreation. What is pancreation? Well, it's kind of like what we would call today cage fighting. You know, kind of a no-holds bar, get them in a ring, and they would fight till somebody won. They also had equestrian events. They also had, unlike the Olympics, they had musical events and some artistic kinds of things like that. And so they were also known for those games. And even those games were known for their extravagance. But here's something that wasn't extravagant about it. Do you know what the winner of the Isthmian Games won? If you won first place, defeated everybody else, you got a crown of celery. That's it. A crown of celery. And I don't know how long that would last, but I'm taking not very long. And then the last thing I want you to know about Corinth is Paul started this church in Corinth. And we read about that over in Acts chapter 18. And he did it by going down to the synagogue on the Sabbath and answering questions. So, you know, as I was doing some research on this, I was kind of thinking to myself, you know, we name churches a lot of times after geographical areas. You know, Burning Bush was named after Burning Bush community, or actually the community was named after the church. But a lot of times churches are named after the geographical area that they're in. And then sometimes they're named after, you know, people or things in the New and the Old Testament. I used to go to a church called Berean Baptist Church, and over in the book of Acts, Bereans were known as these people that really studied the scriptures and adopted their conduct according to the scriptures. So it was a very spiritual name. And, you know, sometimes you have, you know, names like Mount Olivet and Bethel and Bethany, you know, Baptist churches and things like that. And I was just curious, so I looked it up. We actually have churches called Corinthian or Corinthian Baptist churches, which to me is kind of really interesting, since the church at Corinth really didn't stand for Christianity. They stood for wealth and pleasure and immorality. And I just thought that was kind of interesting that somebody would name a church Corinthian Baptist Church. But that kind of gives you a little bit of background. Now, when you look at the book, it's kind of broken down into four main sections. There's the introduction, and then there's conclusion. Those are two of the sections. And then in the first six chapters, Paul kind of deals with some issues that have kind of popped up there. And there's some incest issues, and there's some misunderstandings about the cross. And, you know, then he addressed, like, legal issues, like should Christians take each other to court and those types of things. And then he gets to chapter 7, and he begins to answer some questions. And so there's this whole kind of question and answer thing that he goes through. And we're going to kind of be in that part of the book this morning. This area where Paul is answering questions. So beginning in chapter 7, here's some of the questions. He talks about marriage. And he talks about divorce. What about marriage? What about divorce? Chapters 8 through 10, he deals with Christian freedom or Christian liberty. If I'm a Christian, what kind of things can I do? And does it matter if it hurts somebody else's feelings, or if it's a stumbling block to somebody else? And then in chapter 11, he talks about church conduct. Chapter 12, he talks about spiritual gifts. Chapter 15, he talks about the resurrection. But we're going to be in those chapters this morning where he's talking about Christian freedom. Can a person that's a Christian kind of do whatever they please as long as it doesn't violate Scripture? You know, every generation has their hot topics. You know, every generation of Christians. You know what the hot topics were when I was growing up? Could a guy have long hair? That was a major topic when I was growing up. Could women wear pants? That was a big topic in the churches that I grew up in. Could Christians go to movies? I mean, period, like even Disney movies. That was a hot topic. Another hot topic was, believe it or not, playing cards. Could you play playing cards if you were not gambling? Was that okay to do? Now, this generation, there are different topics. Topics today might include, is it okay for a Christian to drink socially? Sometimes there's questions about movies and what you watch on TV, and, you know, should you watch movies that have a lot of drug use in them or sexual immorality and those kind of things. So every generation kind of has their hot button topics. So do you know what the topic was that he deals with in chapter 8 through 10 as it relates to freedom? The topic for them was, could you eat meat that was offered to idols? Now we hear that and we're like, what is that about? I mean, what is the issue there? Well, here's what's going on. Remember, we mentioned earlier that you have all these pagan temples there. And literally, tons of meat is offered every day to these idols. And the priest would eat some of this meat, but they're not going to eat tons of meat every day. So then that meat would be taken down to the local meat market and it would be sold. And most likely, because it had already been used, so to speak, it would be sold at a cheaper price. And some Christians would buy this meat because it was cheaper. And then they would, you know, serve it. Then there were other Christians that were like, how can you do that? How can you buy meat and serve it at your table when it's been offered to idols? So you had these two groups of people, Christian groups, that had this disagreement over this meat issue. And the one group that's doing it, they're like, look, we're not violating any scriptural principles. We can do whatever we want in Christ. That freedom issue that I was just talking about. But yeah, this other group, it was a real stumbling block to them. So Paul begins to address that. And he's addressing this whole freedom issue and talking to them about it. And he's telling them that he has lived his life in such a manner that he's not going to be a stumbling block. No matter what the issue is, even though he might have freedom to do that, he's not going to do something that is going to cause other Christians to stumble. And so he's going through all of this, and he kind of reaches this conclusion at the end of chapter 10. And in verses 31 and following, it reads like this. So this is kind of his conclusion of the matter. So whether you eat or drink, okay, so we're talking about that meat, eating of the meat of the idols, offered to idols and all that. He said, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. And then he goes on and says, do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everyone in every way, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. So he gets to chapter 10, the end of chapter 10. He said, no matter what you do, do it for God's glory. And if you're going to exercise your freedom from the law, he says, if you're going to do that, make sure that you do it for God's glory. Don't do it for yourself. If this is just about you and your preferences and you get your way, don't do it. He said, do it for God's glory. And further, he kind of states, don't be the one that causes anyone to stumble. Try to please everybody. Seek the good of the entire church body. So that kind of wraps up chapter 10. Chapter 1 of chapter 11 really should be the last verse of chapter 10. And you may even notice in your Bible, like in my Bible, there's like, it goes from verse 33 straight into chapter 11, verse 1, and then there's a space and a new heading, because it's like the translators or the people that have developed the NIV realize that. So verse 1, why I'm telling you this is because it's important to understand, it's still connected with verses 31, 33 in the previous chapters. And then verse 2 of chapter 11 kind of starts this new topic. So it's connected with it, and he says again, verse 1, that simple verse, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. Literally, if you don't translate it into Greek, it says, imitators of me be according as I also am of Christ. Now, I want you to just stop for a minute and think about that verse. Just ponder what he said. Let that impact you a little bit. Paul is saying, If you follow my example, that's like following Christ. Just think about the impact of that. If you follow me, that's like following Christ. My life so mimics, my life so imitates Christ, that if you follow me, I resemble his life, that if you follow me, that'd be like following Christ. That's what Paul is saying. What a statement. Isn't that crazy that he could say something like that? So I just want to kind of break this down. It's kind of a simple breakdown, really, just your basic who, what, and why kind of thing. So let's just kind of break it down a little bit. What is it that the Corinthians are to do? Paul says, follow me. This word follow means to imitate, like we were talking about those kids earlier. It means to follow. It means to imitate. It's where we actually get our English word mimic. In other words, Paul's saying, imitate me. Mimic me. Not only that, but the verb tense here tells us that Paul is saying, when you do this, do it as a continual habit. This isn't a one-side mimic me one time kind of thing. It's something that he's saying do over and over again. Follow me, mimic me, imitate me. Make it a habit, a continual habit. You know, they say it takes like 6 weeks to form or break a habit. And have you ever done this, like maybe on Saturday morning, you pull out of your driveway and 5 minutes into wherever you're going, you find yourself headed to work instead of whatever your destination was that particular day. Several years ago, I was coming back from soccer practice, and we had another boy with us that I was supposed to take home. And so I drive home, pull a 20-minute drive, pull all the way into the driveway, and then one of my boys goes, "Hey, Dad, we were supposed to take Jesse home." Jesse just sitting in the back seat. Nobody said a word. And of course, I'm just going home. And that little trip cost me 40 minutes because Jesse wasn't on the way. And so 20 minutes back to his house, 20 minutes back. So it took, you know, altogether it took me an hour to get home that night. But it's just what we do sometimes. Researches actually tell us that we follow scripts. And scripts are these things that we do every day, and we get where we don't even think about it. And, you know, it could be shampooing your hair, driving to work, combing your hair, brushing your teeth. There's just things that we've scripted. You know, shaking people's hands, and of course you always say, well, how are you? And then you get the very predictable, well, I'm fine. And this is kind of embarrassing, but I did this on Father's Day. You know, everybody's wishing everybody a Father's Day, and you kind of fall into that script, and I shake a young man's hand, and he says, "Happy Father's Day," and I said, "Happy Father's Day," and as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm trying to pull them back in, because he didn't have any kids. But it's just that scripted, researchers tell us, and they say the reason for that is our brains do that so that we can pay attention to the things that take more effort and actually take some decision-making. So Paul, the challenge is here, I want this to become part of your script, so to speak. I want this just to be something that you continually do over and over, like brushing your teeth or driving to work or combing your hair. I want it to be a continual type thing, to imitate me, to follow my example, to mimic me. So that's the first thing, the what. And then who is it that they are to follow or imitate? Paul says it's him in this particular place. The reason for that is he's already given himself as the example to follow in chapter 9 and 10. He's already laid that out, that he's the one that's not going to be a stumbling block, and they can follow his example. So he said, I want you to follow me. And he says, follow me because I'm not a stumbling block. Because I place the good of everyone before myself. I mean, as you look at your life, he says, follow me. And when you do that, it'll be like following Christ. Some pretty big shoes to fill that he's talking about here. And then why? That's the third part. He says, because my example is good. I'm living like Christ. I'm living like Christ so much that you don't even need to see Christ. If you see me, you can see Christ. It almost seems like he's placing himself on a pedestal, but when you examine the entire life of Paul, you realize it's not really about being on a pedestal. But he's just encouraging people and challenging people. You don't even have to see Christ. If you see me, you'll see Christ. You know, Leo Iacocca has passed away, but you know, one of the things that he did is he kind of saved Chrysler. Of course, Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors were the big three back in the day, and Chrysler was going under, and they brought in Lee Iacocca, and of course the government helped some too, but he is kind of credited with saving Chrysler because it was going to go under and go bankrupt. And in his autobiography, he writes this: the speed of the boss is the speed of the train. In other words, the train will not go faster than the lead locomotive. And what he did is Lee Iacocca kind of placed himself up, kind of like Paul was doing, to change things around. One of the first things that he did when he became the chairman of Chrysler was he changed his salary to $1 a year. And he was kind of setting the example there. And then he had previously worked at Ford, and he had seen the opulence there at Ford with all the glass and the white-coated waiters that would serve the executives lunch and all those kind of things. And he did away with all those kind of things. And he set new standards of how things were going to be different at Chrysler. And he was setting the tone. Well, Paul is setting the tone here. He's setting the tone for the Corinthians, but by application us, of that our lives ought to reflect Christ. They ought to imitate Christ. I mean, conclusion, literally, he is saying that the Corinthians reproduce in their lives the same pattern that they saw in his, because his life was patterned after Christ. That's what he's suggesting here. He's saying, I've patterned my life after Christ. I'm not a stumbling block. I'm not offensive to people. I refuse to take advantages of the liberties that I probably could. I mean, certainly Paul could have ate of meat that had been offered to idols, and it wouldn't have been a sin. But he said, I'm not going to do that because it might bother somebody else. And he's asking the Corinthians to do the same. So this verse, it challenges me. It challenged me long before I became a pastor, long before that. But it challenges me to set an example so that other people can see Christ through me. And I say that prayerfully and cautiously. As I mentioned earlier, not by any stretch of the imagination have I mastered this verse. I'm not perfect. I know you need me to tell you that in case you were wondering. But I make mistakes and I misjudge situations, and at times I just plain old blow it. I cannot say like Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. But it's a great challenge. It's a great challenge to me. Now my challenge to you, would you accept that challenge in your own life? We all have people watching us. Whether you like it or not, people are watching you. And it doesn't matter if it's at your workplace. It doesn't matter if it's in school or home. Someone, probably a lot more than just one, probably plural, are watching you. How are you doing? Can they see Christ in you? Can they see Christ in you so much that if they follow your example, that's kind of like following Christ, or at least we're bringing them closer to Christ? Or you have to say this morning, probably like most of us, I have work to do. If a colleague, a peer, a fellow student, a family member is watching you, are they in big trouble? for being able to see Christ in you. Do you have work to do to settle this morning? I think most everybody in here remembers the blizzard of 1993, the blizzard of the century that shut down the entire Atlantic seaboard. I wasn't living here at the time. I had lived here, moved away, so I was gone at that particular time. I understand around here it was about 20 inches of snow. Up in the mountains of North Carolina, where I was living at that particular time, we had about 36 to 40 inches and snow drifts of 5 to 8 feet. And for 2 weeks, we couldn't drive up to my house. It was about halfway up the side of a mountain. So to get to work, literally every day, to get to the main part of the camp there, I would ski down. And then at the end of the day, I'd throw my skis on my shoulder and hike back up. And it snowed for about 3 straight days up there in the mountains. And my wife actually got stranded. She was at work when the snowstorm started. It was about 4 or 5 days before they finally were able to get her home. But the kids literally kind of, they got cabin fever after a while. So on the 3rd day when the snow finally stopped, I mean, they were just ready to get out in it. And I mean, 3 feet of snow. And so they're ready to get out. And so Austin was probably, I guess he was 4 at the time. And so we get out in the snow, and we're going to go down to the main part of the camp. And it's a chore for me to walk in the snow, because I don't have my skis with me, obviously, because I got him with me. And so he's following me, and as long as he stayed in my footprints, he was fine. But as soon as he would try to make his own path, he would just be flailing. I mean, he just couldn't even move. All that powder would just swallow him up. I mean, he looked like a fish sitting on sand. He was flopping and flailing around. Now, as long as he stayed in my prints, and he figured that out pretty quick, as long as I stay in Daddy's footprints, I'm okay. But if I don't and I get out, I'm going to get stuck, I'm going to flail, and those kinds of things. In a spiritual sense, who is following in your footsteps? Parents, we all know our kids are following us and watching us and hopefully walking in those footprints. But maybe the bigger question is not only who, but where are your footprints going? Where are they leading? My prayer this morning is that each of us will just kind of look into our lives, see where we are with kind of the Apostle Paul's challenge here. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. Would you pray with me, please?